As the day dragged on, they saw nobody, and eventually they joined Cotton Blossom in an empty stall near their horses. They drank water from their canteens and chewed on jerked beef from their provisions. Nathan fed Cotton Blossom hunks of jerky, and finally the three of them dozed in the heat of the afternoon. It was near sundown when they finally heard the rattle of wagons announcing the arrival of Roy Bean and his Mexican teamsters. The wagons were drawn up near the barn. The oxen were unharnessed and turned into an adjoining corral. Bean entered the barn looking for Nathan and Yuli.
Well, I reckon nobody come hunting you.
No, but a pair of hombres was looking for you.
Not really. We heard them talking and they had the notion to look around for something of yours they could take for back rent. Their names were Layton and Barnfield, and it seemed like Layton's idea. Cotton Blossom bit them on the behind and they left with talk of a suit.
Oh, Lord Almighty, Stone, I gotta have me that dog. I'll give you $50 for him.
Sorry, I can't part with him. He's all the family I have left.
Yeah, now as I look at my mic closer, I reckon he does have your eyes. I finally collected some freight money that's been owing me since spring. I went by and give some to Layton to get the greedy varmint off in my back.
You caught your rent up then?
Some of it. Don't owe for but 5 months now.
Since we can't go into town, how are the chances of us going to the house long enough for a decent meal? We'll bring our own grub.
There's no need for that. I'll feed the dog, too. Come on. Del Mano and Renato can eat after they bring them other teams and wagons from town.
Speaking of town, have the McClendon riders been searching for us?
No. And you ain't got to worry about that. McClendon just slapped a $1,000 bounty on each of your heads and telegraphed the sheriffs in different towns, sending your names and description.
How in hell can he do that? He's not the law, and besides, we fired in self-defense.
That's how powerful he is. He sent men all over town, and they hunted till they found that boarding house where you took a room. They got your names from the register.
Then we won't be safe wherever we go.
That's spilt milk.
They entered the house, and it was just as cluttered as the yard. The living room had no furniture. Instead, there was a pile of wagon canvas, old harnesses, a saddle, bridles, and four enormous wooden kegs that might have once, and perhaps still, contained whiskey. From there, they went directly into the dining room. There was a heavy, handmade X-frame oak table that could easily seat 20. There was a backless oak bench on each side, each one stretching the length of the table.
Sit. I know where everything is.
Nathan and Yuli took their seats on one side of the table, watching Bean as he fired up an enormous wood stove that squatted in the adjoining kitchen. He made the coffee first, and when it was ready, cheerfully poured it into unmatched cups. He then set about preparing the meal. He brought knives and forks to the table, and then plates, none of which were alike. Finally, he brought platters of ham, eggs, and fried potatoes. He refilled the coffee cups, returned the pot to the stove, and took his seat on the other side of the table. There was no talk until the meal was finished.
You sure you want a pair of teamsters that's dodging the law?
I ain't sure that'll be a problem. You know, Texas is under military law, and that means most towns has got a government-appointed sheriff. From what I've seen in Austin and Houston, lawmen that's been appointed by the Federals don't get excited as long as it's Rebs against Rebs. You gun down a blue coat, they'll set the whole damn army after your hide. I reckon when old McClendon hollers froggy, San Antone jumps. But that don't include the Federals. They're spread too thin, and they scared to death of the Comanches.
The soldiers control the telegraph, then.
You're damn right they do. McClendon raised enough hell, I'd say, till they let him send his telegrams. But they won't mean doodly coming from him. There's talk the officer in charge in San Antone might get raked over for allowing McClendon to use a telegraph. He'd just be ready to move out at first light.
August 27th, 1866. Bound for Corpus Christi. Bean's wagon led out at dawn. Del Mano and Renato followed, while Yuli and Nathan brought up the rear with the fourth and fifth wagons. Both their horses and the pack horse trailed Nathan's wagon on lead ropes. Nathan had made it his business to be last in line, knowing that Cotton Blossom would follow the wagon. It would lessen the chances of their being surprised from the rear by Comanches or anyone else. The empty wagons made good time. By Bean's estimate, 15 miles. Once that was accomplished, they had stopped to make a supper fire.
You'd do a hell of a lot better if you took a load south from San Antonio. Don't you ever haul anything to Corpus Christi?
Nothing to haul. Hell, after 4 years of war, Texas ain't got nothing to ship out. Everything's got to be brung in.
As Bean had predicted, the Comanches didn't molest the empty wagons. 60 miles north of Corpus Christi, they had built their supper fire on the east bank of the Nueces, where the river began its southward journey toward the Gulf. Suddenly, Cotton Blossom trotted a few yards downriver, his hackles rising.
Somebody's coming.
Indians, maybe?
No, it's just one horse.
Keep your guns handy. In these times, you don't give no man the benefit of the doubt.
The stranger evidently shared Bean's skepticism, for he reined up some distance away.
Hello to camp. I'm friendly. Got three men down the river a ways, and we've had engine trouble.
You ride on in, but keep your hands where we can see them.
The stranger rode in, reins looped about the saddle horn, his hands shoulder high. His horse was a bay, and nothing seemed unusual about the man. His black Stetson had seen a lot of dust, wind, and rain, and his flannel shirt and Levi's pants were far from new. His colt was tied down on his left hip, butt forward for a crosshand draw. He might have been a drifter, or even a cowboy, although Nathan noted that he sat a single-rigged saddle.
Get down!
There's four of us, two of them bad hurt. I'm Blevins. Me and Springer wasn't hurt. Springer stayed with Coe and Walker while I come looking for help.
The nearest town's 60 miles away. How'd you know we was here?
We're downwind from you. I smelt smoke from your fire. Damn Comanches killed three of our horses and both pack mules. We got no way to get Coe and Walker to a dock, and no way to move our goods the mules was carrying. If your wagons ain't too loaded to make room for us, we'd pay.
Depends on where you're headed. We got freight waiting for us in Corpus Christi. I reckon we could take you and your supplies there.
We'd expect nothing more. Must be a dock there, and we could buy horses and pack mules.
We'll take two wagons. One for the wounded men, and one for saddles, pack saddles, and the load the mules was carrying. I'll take my wagon, and Eli, you drive yours. Stone, saddle your horse and ride on ahead with Blevins. Damano, you and Renato stay here in camp.
It was a strange request, and for a fleeting moment, Nathan thought he caught some alarm in Blevins' eyes. Nathan saddled his horse, mounted, and followed Blevins downriver, and he believed his own thoughts were in line with Bean's. In leaving Nathan's wagon behind, they also were leaving two of the horses. Bean clearly wasn't sure of this situation and wanted Nathan mounted and unencumbered by the heavy freight wagon. Nathan caught up to the other rider, for he had a question.
Lucky for you making it to the river. Where did the Comanches attack?
Maybe 2 miles east of where we stood and fought. We know there was water ahead because we could see some greenery.
After wounding two men and leaving you afoot, it's some mystery why they didn't take your scalps and your goods. You must have laid some of them low.
Yeah, there was eight of them and we gunned down four.
Nathan said nothing, but his sharp eyes noted the absence of a rifle on Blevins' saddle, nor was there a boot for one. While it was possible the four had fought off Comanches with revolvers, it didn't seem likely. Nathan wanted to look at the saddles belonging to the other riders. From the corner of his eye, he caught a movement to his left. Unbidden, Cotton Blossom followed. It took a few minutes for Nathan and Blevins to reach the place near the river where the four men had stood off the Comanches, and it took just a moment for Nathan to discover that all had not been as Blevins had claimed. The three horses had obviously died as the result of Comanche arrows, but the pack mules had been shot through the head.
All this wasn't Comanche work. Those mules were shot at close range. Hell, I can see the powder burns from here.
And just what would you have done? They come down on us out of nowhere, and there wasn't no cover, not even a mesquite bush. We needed a barricade, and we needed it quick. Better the mules than us.
Where are the pack saddles and their loads?
Me and Springer managed to tote everything onto the river. We know the Comanches would come back for their dead, even if they'd done it after dark. And we didn't want them taking all we had. Hell, we lost enough.
When he and Blevins reached the camp near the river, Nathan wasn't at all surprised to find that while Coe and Walker had been wounded, the wounds weren't nearly as serious as Blevins had implied. He introduced his three companions, and Nathan didn't like the looks of them. Coe was minus his shirt, and a dirty bandage covered most of his left shoulder, while Walker's Levi's had been slit and his right leg had been swathed in bandages above the knee. Springer, Coe, and Walker, like Blevins, wore range clothes, and each of them were armed with Colts. The butts of the weapons were slick, Nathan noticed, from frequent use. It was immediately apparent that the wounded men, if they had been wounded at all, were in no danger. Nathan saw it as a ploy Blevins had used to influence Roy Bean's judgment. The four men, gun-wise and otherwise, were a salty bunch. Obviously, all they needed were horses to replace the mounts they'd lost and a means of transporting the heavy pack saddles. A quick look at the three men's saddles revealed that only two of them carried rifles. Nathan looked long and hard at the pack saddles while the four men eyed him. Among them, the four could have carried necessary provisions in their saddlebags and bedrolls. Certainly, the enormous canvas-wrapped loads the mules had borne were more than grub and personal belongings. Nathan stood beside his horse, waiting for Bean and Yuli to arrive with the wagons. There was something wrong here, and since Bean had made a commitment to these men, it would be up to him to reach some decision. Bean reined up his teams and stepped down from the wagon box. Yuli remained where she was, while Blevins again introduced his companions. Roy Bean wasted no time in saying exactly what Nathan Stone had thought.
Bye. God, Blevins, them mules were shot at close range, and your pards ain't more than nicked, if that. I don't take kindly to having a man lie to me. You ain't got enough money to hire my wagons, and I won't take you nowhere without some damn convincing talk. Now, talk!
Bean had his Winchester in the crook of his right arm, but the four men had their eyes on Nathan Stone. He stood with his thumbs hooked in his pistol belt near the butts of his Colts. Yuli had drawn her wagon up beside Bean's and now leaned back against the seat, right hand resting near her Colt.
All right, damn it, I wasn't leveling with you. I only said what I had to. Like I told Stone, when the Comanches come down on us, we had no cover. We had to ford up quick and it was the mules or us. Now we're needing a wagon, maybe two, so as we can get to the nearest town. We're on government business and you'll be paid.
I got all the government business I can afford. Now, you lied to me once, Blevins. If you can't show some proof you're with the government, then the bunch of you can sit here till you rot.
I got proof in my shirt pocket.
Now, you use your left hand and do it real slow.
Slowly, Blevins complied. He then tossed the object to Bean, who caught it in his left hand. It proved to be a silver star in a circle. The badge of a Texas Ranger.
I reckon that covers you, but it ain't big enough to cover the rest of these hombres. If they got something like this, it's time to show it. You first, and you do it slow.
Bean pointed to Winchester at Springer. Slowly, Springer removed another of the silver emblems from a pocket, and Bean shifted the muzzle of the Winchester toward Coe, only to be shown a third Ranger symbol.
I reckon you seen enough.
You reckon wrong. One more.
Bean swung the Winchester's deadly snout toward Walker. There was no change in Bean's expression when Walker produced the badge. Again, he turned to Blevins.
Just where was you bound when the Comanches clipped your wings? For sure you wasn't going to Corpus Christi. And now you're ready to pay to go there.
None of your damn business where we were bound. You said you're going to Corpus Christi. We're going there because it's the nearest place we can buy horses and pack mules. Are you satisfied?
No, I ain't. I'd take you to Corpus Christi and I'm making myself a party to whatever it is you're up to. I don't care damn for the wiving, but I'm sure as hell gonna know where you're bound to end up.
All right. This and no more. We're on our way to the outpost at Laredo. When we get to Corpus Christi, why don't you telegraph the Laredo Post Commander?
Well, maybe I will. Load your saddles and pack them in the second wagon, and them if you need a ride, pile into mine.
Bean mounted the wagon box and waited until Springer, Coe, and Walker clambered in through the open pucker of the wagon. Nathan thought the wounded men handled themselves well, maybe a little too well. By the time the two wagons reached Bean's camp, it was almost dark. Cotton Blossom was nowhere to be seen. It was significant that Bean said nothing to the new arrivals about taking a turn at watch. The saddles belonging to Springer, Coe, and Walker, along with the loaded, canvas-wrapped pack saddles, remained in Yuli's wagon, and the four men were never far away. The questionable quartet were within Bean's camp, but they were not part of it. They spread their blankets near Yuli's wagon, while Yuli and Nathan distanced themselves from the four. It was almost time for Nathan and Yuli to begin the second watch when Cotton Blossom finally appeared.
He doesn't like them. Rangers or not, I'm with him.
Nathan said nothing, waiting until they joined Bean, Delmano, and Renato. It would be the first opportunity they'd had to talk freely, and Nathan wasted no time. Bean said nothing, listening.
Maybe you're satisfied, but I'm not. I've seen the varmints looking at our horses. They're needing three horses, and we have three. A damn shame we have oxen pulling the wagons instead of mules.
Ain't it, though? Them pack saddles is loaded almighty heavy with something. And for now, they're needing a wagon. I don't know where or how they got them Ranger stars. They're real enough, but something about this bunch just don't wash. I'm thinking we best keep our guns handy.
I'm thinking you, Delmano, and Renato had best spread your blankets near enough for us to keep close watch. This bunch could kill all of you while you sleep, giving them the edge over me and Eli.
Yeah, we'll do that. I don't trust this bunch as far as I could fling an ox by the tail.
Neither do we. Just how long do you intend to trail them without calling their hand?
Just till first light. When we're done with breakfast, you and Eli be ready. When Delmano, Renato, and me go to our wagons, it'll be for our Winchesters. You follow my lead and we'll get the drop. And one of us is going after them pack saddle loads. I reckon when we find out just what these hombres is hiding, it'll either prove the truth of what they told us, or we'll see them for what they really are.
With that, followed by Delmano and Renato, Bean faded into the darkness, leaving Nathan, Yuli, and Cotton Blossom alone. They stood beneath cottonwoods, watching as the trio became visible in the dim starlight. They were going to spread their blankets near Bean's wagon.
We'll stay here. Blevins and his friends are down yonder behind your wagon, and we're downwind from them.
None of this makes any sense. I don't believe a word those four have spoken. But if they aren't what they seem, why are they going to Corpus Christi? Even if there are no soldiers, the government freight office will have the telegraph.
If none of us reach Corpus Christi alive, they won't be concerned with us using the telegraph. They could kill us somewhere north of town, and taking our horses, they'd all be mounted. One of them could ride on to Corpus Christi, buy a pair of pack animals, and the four of them could be on their way to the border with nobody the wiser.
But suppose they are Rangers, and when we force their hand, we kill some of them. God, we'll both go to Huntsville for life.
If they're leveling with us, I don't expect any shooting. And if it comes to gunplay over what's in those packs, then these pilgrims are no more Rangers than we are.
The dawn came and breakfast was eaten in silence. Bean, Delmano, and Renato did nothing to arouse suspicion. They caught up their teams, leading them to the wagons as though to be harnessed. But inside the wagon box, next to the seat, each man carried a Winchester, and when they turned with their weapons in their hands, the surprise was total.
Nobody move. If you're what you claim to be, then there won't be no harm done. Stone, you keep your eye on Blevins. Delmano, Renato, and me will cover the others. Eli, get in that wagon and tear into one of them packs. It's time we was knowing what's so almighty valuable to these gents.
Damn you! You'll pay for this!
Bean said nothing. Nathan kept his eyes on the furious Blevins as Yuli climbed into the wagon. She broke into one of the canvas-wrapped packs.
Well?
Gold. Double eagles and canvas bags with the mark of a Houston bank.
The very mention of gold was enough to distract a man, But Blevins and his companions knew what was coming, and the initial shock bought them a small advantage. It was all the edge they were going to get, and the four went for their guns. Blevins fired once, but the shot went wild as two slugs from Nathan's Colt tore into his belly. Springer, Coe, and Walker died without getting off a shot. Yuli climbed out from the wagon and stood looking at the carnage.
I reckon they told us what we needed to know. Somewhere betwixt here and Houston, the Buzzards is picking the bones of four rangers. These varmints stole that gold and was headed for the border sure as hell.
That's a safe bet. And if it was taken from a bank, we're up against more than the Texas Rangers. I'd gamble the Federals are looking for it right now.
You damn right they are. And we're going to protect ourselves by taking everything these varmints has got in their pockets, including them Ranger stars. When we get to Corpus Christi, we're turning it all over to the government. Stone, you search Blevins and we'll get the others.
The search resulted in money, pocket knives, and pocket watches. Walker, Springer, and Coe each had two. A fair indication they had ambushed and robbed their pursuers.
There's a shovel in every wagon. This bunch ain't deserving of it, but we'd be skunks the equal of them if we didn't take time for decent burying.
Nathan, Bean, Delmano, and Renato dug the graves, all within a few feet of one another. When the dead man had been buried and the graves filled in, Bean stood at the head of the graves and removed his hat. Then, with a reverence Nathan would never have believed he possessed, Bean turned his face heavenward.
Lord, we wasn't aiming to gun down these thieves and killers, but they wouldn't have it no other way. Resurrect the varmints or kick them on into hell as you see fit. Amen.
The teams were quickly harnessed, and Bean again led out in the first wagon, the others following. Blevins's horse had been tied behind the wagon Yuli drove. Cotton Blossom again foraged far ahead. It was he who warned them of approaching riders, this time from the south. By the time the six men rode into sight, their blue uniforms identified them, Union soldiers. Bean reined up, signal enough to the trailing wagons, and they reined up as well. Bean held up his hand, and the soldiers drew up beside his wagon. One of them was a lieutenant, one a sergeant, and the remaining four were privates.
I'm Lieutenant Willingham, and this is Sergeant Winkler. We've just been assigned to Corpus Christi, arriving there on packet from New Orleans. We had a telegram waiting for us, ordering us to move out immediately. The four men robbed a bank in Houston, escaping with more than $40,000 in gold. They were pursued by five Texas Rangers. They managed to kill four of the Rangers in an ambush. The fifth Ranger escaped with his life, and he seemed to think the four men were going to cut between San Antonio and Corpus Christi, make a run for the border. Have you seen them?
We have. After they killed the Rangers, they was hit by the Comanches, lost their pack mules and three horses. Showed us them Ranger stars and wanted to ride to Corpus Christi. I'm Roy Bean, and them's all my wagons and drivers behind me. I offered them a ride, but even with them four Ranger stars, we didn't trust them. This morning, we got the drop, and one of my drivers busted into one of them packs. When we found the gold, them four went for their guns. Wasn't nothing we could do but cut them down. Planted them maybe 5 or 6 miles upriver.
You have the gold, then?
We got it. It's in the fourth wagon, and we ain't laid a hand on it, except in the one sack we opened. We went through the pockets of the varmints, and we took everything, even the Ranger stars. The one horse they had is on a lead rope behind the wagon with the gold.
Now, you did exactly the right thing, sir. We were given execution warrants for those four. You did no more than we would have been forced to do had we caught up to them. Now, since you're going on to Corpus Christi, I'd take it as a favor if the gold can remain where it is. I'll post a guard over it at night until we can take it off your hands.
The wagon's empty except for the gold. Leave it there and welcome.
Nathan, Yuli, Delmano, and Renato had left their wagons and had moved close enough to hear the conversation between the officer and Bean.
Two of those men had been wounded, and not by Comanche arrows. They'd been shot.
Well, that fits in with what we were told. The ranger who managed to escape said he thought two of the robbers had been hit during the ambush.
Again, Bean led out, and this time, a soldier rode on each side of Yuli's wagon. Two more followed Nathan's wagon, while Lieutenant Willingham and Sergeant Winkler rode beside Bean's wagon. Despite the delays, they made 15 miles. The soldiers set up their own camp near Bean's, and from dusk until dawn, took turns in pairs, standing watch near the wagon with the gold. The procedure continued for two more days and nights until Bean reined up his wagon near the government warehouse. Yuli swung her wagon wide and then backed it up so that the gold might be conveniently unloaded. Corpus Christi, Texas, September 7th, 1866. Enough freight had backed up to convince Bean they shouldn't lay over any longer than necessary. And the morning after their arrival, they began loading the wagons for the return to San Antonio. It was early September, but the Texas sun showed them no mercy. The bucket of water Bean had brought was good for less than an hour. Delmano and Renato occasionally poured a dipperful over their sweaty heads.
Damn it. Take off long enough to dunk yourselves in the Gulf.
The wagon half-loaded, Nathan and Yuli paused to straighten up, resting their aching backs.
It's been a while since I've sweated like this.
Not me.
Although I wasn't the man-child Daddy wanted, he worked me like one. Until the war killed the market for cotton, I reckon there wasn't a slave anywhere that worked harder than I did. Daddy had a quaint way of thinking. An unmarried woman living at home had to earn her keep, and he was the judge as to how much work she must do to earn it.
Once Bean had designated what was to be loaded, he helped load the wagons, wrestling pieces heavy enough for two men. They worked steadily, and before sundown, the wagons were loaded with all the teams could pull.
We'll get us a good feed of town grub, hit the blankets early, and pull out at first light.
Bean headed for one of the saloons, followed by Delmano and Renato. Nathan and Yuli, leaving their horses and the pack horse at the hitch rail, entered a cafe, followed by Cotton Blossom. The place was far from full, and the few patrons eyed the newcomers, especially Cotton Blossom. The cook eyed the dog.
Mister, the dog stays outside.
He's a paying customer. We'll take a table near the back, and I'll see that he doesn't bother anybody.
The pair took their seats at the table, Cotton Blossom curled up near their feet.
Nathan, there was a man who spent most of the day watching us load the wagons. I swear I've seen him somewhere.
I saw him, and I'm wondering if his interest in what we were doing didn't have something to do with those 20 cases of Winchesters and the canisters of ammunition we were loading. In the hands of a Comanche, each of those rifles is worth its weight in gold.
Outlaw whites might attack us and then deal with the Comanches?
Why not? It's happened before.
It seemed like a good idea at first, bullwhacking. Now I'm not so sure.
After they'd eaten and paid for their meal, they stepped out into the gathering darkness. To the right of the cafe entrance, new lumber had been stacked head high, and within the shadow of it, Nathan caught a fleeting movement. Colt in his hand, he turned to face the danger. Lead slammed into his right side just above his belt. Yuli was on her knees, returning fire.
I got him, Nathan. I got him.
The patrons in the cafe remained there. Men erupted from the nearby saloon, Bean, Delmano, and Renato in the lead. Cotton Blossom crouched over Nathan, his teeth bared, daring anyone to come close.
Lord God.
Yuli had calmed Cotton Blossom and was on her knees, still clutching the Colt. Blood welled out of a wound just below her left knee, but it was Nathan Stone who looked dead.
Delmano, get over yonder to that government warehouse and tell them soldiers to get over here pronto and bring the doc with them. Eli, you got any say with that dog, you get him away before the doc gets here. Let me have that Colt. I'll see if you plug the varmint that started all this.
Her eyes on Nathan, Yuli surrendered the Colt, and Bean moved cautiously toward the stacked lumber. In the shadow lay a man belly down, his right hand still clutching a revolver. Bean rolled the body over so that a patch of light from the cafe window shone on the face. Immediately he recognized the man who'd been watching them load the wagons. Even in the poor light, Bean could see the pair of bullet holes in the chest oozing blood, and barely visible from a shirt pocket, the corner of a piece of paper. Without knowing what it was, Bean took it. Within minutes, Lieutenant Willingham, Sergeant Winkler, and two privates arrived. With them was a medic, Lieutenant Pilkington, who had just been assigned to the outpost at Corpus Christi. It was fortunate that Lieutenant Willingham recognized Nathan and Yuli as two of Bean's drivers, recalling their part in recovering the stolen gold. Lieutenant Pilkington knelt beside Nathan, and failing to find a pulse, tried the big artery on the neck.
He's alive. Get him on the stretcher and down to quarters, quickly.
The two privates who had brought the stretcher lifted Nathan onto it and set off toward the government warehouse where the soldiers were temporarily quartered. Sergeant Winkler helped Yuli to her feet. She leaned on him, and the two followed Lieutenant Pilkington. Lieutenant Willingham then turned to Roy Bean.
What do you know about this?
Not much more than you do. Stone and Prater come here for grub while me and my Mex drivers went to the saloon. Next thing we knowed, guns was blasting away. We heard five shots, three of them real quick. Last two, I'd say, was fired by Prater. I reckon it was them that killed the bushwhacker.
He's dead, then?
Yeah, considerable. He's over yonder betwixt the cafe and that pile of lumber.
If you'll witness it, I'll search the body. Perhaps we can learn his identity and what his motive was.
At that moment, men within the cafe yielded to their curiosity and came out to see what had happened. Among them was the cook with a lighted lantern. Bean borrowed the lantern and followed the officer into the shadows where the dead man lay. The search produced only a pocket knife, most of a plug of tobacco, and three double eagles.
Strange way this happened. You have no idea, I suppose, as to the reason behind it?
Oh, nothing for sure. Now I got me a problem. Five loaded wagons and three drivers, including me. Now, if you got no objection, I reckon I ought to talk to the doc and see what the verdict is. Prater took one in the leg, but Stone might have bought the farm. Looked almighty bad.
Well, come along. It might be too soon to learn anything if Lieutenant Pilkington has to dig out the slugs.
Bunks had been set up in the back of the government warehouse, and on one of them lay Nathan Stone. His upper chest had already been bandaged, and the medic was cleansing the nasty wound in his side. Yuli sat on one of the bunks, anxiety in her eyes. One of the privates held a lamp close, providing as much light as possible for Lieutenant Pilkington. Bean and Willingham kept their silence until Pilkington had bandaged the second wound, and when the medic finally faced them, he answered their questions without being asked.
If he never has another piece of luck, he's got no gripe coming. Shot clean through both times. If either slug had struck a bone, he'd be a dead man. He'll need a month of rest.
I'm glad for him. I was just talking to the lieutenant here, and he reckons he can put him up at the Shore Hotel till I get back from San Antone.
We're obliged. We can pay.
We're obliged to you and Stone for your help in recovering that stolen gold. We'll stable your horses.
I believe this man should remain here for the night. His worst enemy is infection, and I'll need to look in on him at regular intervals.
I'll stay too, then.
Roy Bean left them there, returning to the loaded wagons where Delmano and Renato waited. Bean unfolded the paper he'd removed from the dead man's pocket and lighted a match so that he could see. It was a bounty poster, and while there were no photographs, there was an accurate description of the pair Bean knew as Nathan Stone and Eli Prater. There was a bounty of $1,000 on each of their heads. Old McClendon was dead serious. After Lieutenant Pilkington had heavily dosed Nathan with laudanum, he turned to Yuli.
You're welcome to some of this. While your wound isn't all that serious, it may cause you some pain. This will help you sleep.
Thanks, but I am to stay awake. You done well tending to Nathan's wounds, and we're obliged. Now about all that's to be done is to see him through the fever. If you get me a bottle of whiskey, I'll do that.
You're right. You can pour whiskey down him as well as I can. He must sweat out the infection. I'll go get the whiskey.
While the medic was gone, Roy Bean returned. Having made certain that none of the military personnel was around, he took the bounty poster from his pocket and passed it to Yuli.
I took this off in the varmint that done the shooting, and I reckon it's clear enough why he done it. I told Lieutenant Willingham that I didn't know why you were shot. It won't help if word gets around.
Yuli sat up, leaning over enough to see by the light of the lamp next to Nathan's bunk. Quickly, she read the death warrant for Nathan and herself.
I just thought you'd ought to know. Come morning, get yourselves a room in that hotel and lay low for a while. Stay out of the saloons, and when Stone can ride, you get the hell out of Texas till this blows over.
Thanks. Now you have two wagons for which you have no drivers. But we hadn't counted on this.
Hell, you got no business going back to San Antone, even if you was able. Delmano and Renato met up with three Mexes that's needing some reason for being on this side of the border. I hired two of them to drive the extra wagons back to San Antone. If my credit's good for another wagon and teams, I'm hiring the third one, too. Just watch your back, Eli, and when your pard's able, saddle up and ride. Good luck.
On his way out, Bean passed Lieutenant Pilkington, returning with a quart bottle of whiskey.
If he gets too restless during the night, then don't hesitate to wake me.
I doubt I'll be needing to, but thanks.
The rest of the bunks had been moved well away from Nathan and Yuli, and Yuli prepared for a long vigil. Some hours into the night she awoke, and feeling Nathan's brow, found he had a raging fever. It was time for the whiskey. She poured a third of the bottle down him. For just a moment he opened his eyes, but there was no recognition in them. She eased him back down on the bunk. As the lieutenant had promised, Yuli's wound began to ache, and she had no trouble keeping her eyes open for the rest of the night. When the windows began to gray with first light, Lieutenant Pilkington came to examine Nathan's wounds and to change the bandages.
He could use another slug of that whiskey. I'd not be surprised if this fever stays with him all day, but it should break sometime tonight.
I'll give him half of what's left. This morning, if you will allow me the use of your stretcher and two of your men, I'll take us a room at the hotel.
First, I'd better take a look at your own wound. How are you feeling?
You're right. That leg hurts like hell, but I can stand on it.
I don't recommend that for any longer than it takes you to reach the hotel. Lie down, stretch out that leg.
The wound was clean, and Pilkington nodded in satisfaction. He doused it with more disinfectant and bound it with a clean bandage.
It should heal clean. Here's a day's dose of laudanum. Now one of us can help you to the hotel, if you like.
Thanks, but it's not that far. While you're gone for the stretcher, I'll pour some more whiskey down, Nathan.
Yuli paid for 2 weeks in advance at the Shore Hotel, and since it was still early, Nathan was moved there without attracting undue attention. For the time and place, the Shore was fancy. There were braided rugs on the floors, and the rooms were large. Extra blankets had been provided for Nathan so that he might sweat out the fever. The room's single window was curtained, and the furniture was made of heavy oak. Lieutenant Pilkington came by in the afternoon.
His temperature's down. By tomorrow, he'll be out of danger, I think. I'll leave you enough laudanum to get him through the night, and by this time tomorrow, he should be awake and ready for some food. I'll see you in the morning.
By late afternoon, Nathan's fever had broken, and near supper time, he opened his eyes.
Oh, God.
Your wounds hurt?
No, but my head does. I feel like I've been on a 3-day drunk. My mouth and throat feel like a desert. Water.
Yuli fished a tin cup out of a saddlebag and filled it with water for Nathan to drink.
Oh, thanks. What in the hell have you been pouring down me?
Whiskey. You've been burning up with fever.
How long have I?
Since early last night. The army doctor dug 2 bullets out of you, and you're supposed to rest.
Rest? Hell. Reach me that chamber pot. Then I want to know who cut down on us, where I am.
All right, damn it, I'll tell you.
And she did. Nathan had closed his eyes, and she thought he'd dropped off to sleep, but when she stopped talking, he was looking straight at her.
This whole thing just makes me mad as hell. That bushwhacking varmint put 2 slugs in me before I could pull my iron. I came off like a damn greenhorn, and I reckon I got just what I deserved.
Well, by God, I'd hoped after that shooting at San Antone, I wouldn't have to tangle with the Nathan Stone Pride again. but I reckon I was wrong. What's bothering you is that you got gunned down in an ambush and a female pistolier saved your bacon.
That silenced him. The truth was, he felt inadequate. This woman, Yuli Prater, had come to his rescue for the second time in a matter of days, and while he didn't wish to seem ungrateful, it rankled his hide, made him feel less than a man. She knew him too well.
The damn shoe fits, you gotta wear it. I got no call to look down on you. With two slugs in me, I was in no condition to fight back. I'm beholden to you, because if you hadn't plugged him, the varmint that cut me down would have escaped. I'm a prideful man, and there's times when old pride jumps on me and digs in the spurs before I know he has control of me.
You were being a little selfish wanting to gun the varmint down. Hell, he was trying to kill me too. I had as much right to him as you did.
The following morning, Lieutenant Pilkington came by and was amazed to find Nathan Stone sitting on the edge of the bed, eating breakfast.
You should be in that bed. Do you want to start those wounds bleeding again?
I wouldn't be sitting here if I wasn't up to it. It's a testimony as to how well you patched me up. I'm obliged.
I can't take all the credit. You were damned lucky. Either of those shots could have killed you if they'd struck bone. When you feel strong enough, Lieutenant Willingham will be wanting to question you. He must file a report on the incident.
Nathan nodded, and the medic departed.
That's all we need, is to have our names on file with the military. Somebody's just liable to put two and two together and ties to that shooting in San Antonio.
Let them. They can't prove we've gunned down anybody that wasn't trying to kill us.
Roy Bean said we should leave Texas as soon as you're able to ride, and do it before they find out we're fugitives.
My God, it puts a crimp in my tail being run out when I've done no wrong. Besides, I believe the killers I'm looking for are here somewhere.
Oh, damn. Nathan Stone's ironclad pride rears its ugly head again. And don't use your manhunt for an excuse, because you don't have so much as a thread of evidence that a single one of those six men is anywhere in Texas.
It was irrefutable logic, and Nathan grinned despite himself. He then stretched out on the bed, weaker than he had been willing to admit.
I reckon we'll go.
Corpus Christi, Texas, September 25th, 1866. 2 weeks after the shooting, a ship arrived from New Orleans. There was much excitement, for the packet had brought a bundle of newspapers only a few days old. Yuli bought one, and the news-starved outpost snatched the rest of them in less than an hour. The paper was a Sunday edition in two sections, so Yuli took one and Nathan the other. Nathan read only a little of the front page when he came off the bed in a hurry.
By God, they're there! In New Orleans!
Who's in New Orleans?
Tobe Snyder and Verge Dillard. But for the one I found in Missouri, I'd lost track of the murdering varmints I'm looking for. Now I know there's two of them in New Orleans. Here, read this.
Yuli took the newspaper and found the brief story that had excited Nathan. Snyder and Dillard were identified as a pair of killers who'd been linked to French Stumberg, the man behind a New Orleans gambling empire. The killers, as the newspaper referred to them, had been freed by the courts through the influence of Stumberg. There was no more, but that was enough.
We ride out at first light tomorrow.
Like hell we do. Lieutenant Pilkington said you should have a month to recover from your wounds. You've had just half that.
It's my damn carcass, and I reckon I know when it's able to ride. I've been all the way across Texas without accomplishing anything except being hogtied by you and getting myself shot. Now I know where two of those murdering sidewinders are, and by God, I'm going after them.
But Lieutenant Pilkington warned him about opening his wounds by riding before they'd properly healed, and Nathan grudgingly agreed to wait another week. Corpus Christi, October 1st, 1866. Nathan and Yuli rode out of town. Cotton Blossom ranged ahead, and with Nathan leading the pack horse, they rode northeastward, following the shoreline.
Do you aim to stop along the way? There's Houston.
I don't aim to stop anywhere in Texas. Like Bean told us, it's time to ride on, and now I have a damn good reason.
They passed to the north of Houston, spending their nights on the plains of East Texas beside a spring or a creek. There was an excitement in Nathan that he found hard to contain, but he was often sobered by something in Yuli's eyes, a despondency that got to him. She would be with him but a few more months, and when she was gone, that haunting look in her eyes would follow Nathan Stone down every lonely trail he would ride. Nathan and Yuli crossed the Mississippi 25 miles south of Natchez.
When we reach New Orleans, we should find us a boarding house with a stable for the horses.
I aim to, since these two skunks I'm after seem to be under the wing of a big-time gambler. It may take me a while just reaching the varmints.
New Orleans, October 16th, 1866. Nathan and Yuli had followed the Mississippi, and their first sight of New Orleans was the western outskirts, which soon would become known as the Garden District. There were no shops, saloons, or hotels, for much of it was residential, with stately two-story dwellings shaded by live oak and magnolia trees. The first identifiable street they reached was St. Charles. They rode for what seemed half a mile before reaching a cross street, which a faded sign said was 7th.
Damn, we should have stayed with the river. This is too highfalutin for boarding houses and hotels.
I think we should shy away from the river. I don't know how it is here, but I talked to a drummer once who had come from St. Louis. He said every drunk thief and killer in town always hangs out near the river.
My kind of people. We'll ride on for another mile or two, and if we don't see a boarding house or hotel, we'll ride south back toward the river.
St. Charles looked like a boulevard into what seemed more and more of a residential area. Virtually all the homes were two-story, many of them taking refuge behind what appeared to be stately marble columns, the whole surrounded by well-kept grounds and spreading oaks. Graceful palms hung their heads over the wide street, offering shade from the October sun. A buckboard drawn by an aging gray horse approached and passed them. A fashionably dressed woman held the reins in her left hand, an open parasol in her right, and seemed not to notice the pair of dusty riders and their pack horse. Cotton Blossom took offense, trotting after the buckboard.
Cotton Blossom, stop that! Come here!
The hound obeyed, not in the least repentant, and gave Nathan a curious look.
I reckon he's never seen anything the equal of that.
My God, neither have I. I can't imagine anybody getting all frocked up like that. This ain't Sunday, is it?
No, it's Thursday, I think. Carnation, if they dress like that in the middle of the week, what do they wear on Sunday?
I don't know. The next decent-looking cross street we come to, I think it's time we cut back toward the river. If we don't find the kind of place we're looking for, there should be somebody we can ask.
They rode south on Utarp, and 9 blocks later found themselves within sight of the Mississippi. As Nathan had expected, there were warehouses, eateries, saloons, and bawdy houses strung out along the river as far as he could see. Far ahead, where the Mississippi fed into the Gulf, the masts of sailing ships were visible.
I doubt we'll find decent quarters by asking directions at a saloon or whorehouse. Let's try one of these warehouses. Where there's wagons backed up, there'll be bullwhackers.
Finding a wagon that had just been loaded, they approached the grizzled old man who was preparing to mount the box.
Partner, we'll be looking to be here a spell. With 3 horses and a dog, we're needing a decent boarding house instead of a hotel. Can you point us in the right direction?
You're looking for the McQueen place out on Bayou Road. Barnaby stables horses for town folks. He raises horses, trains them, and races them. Bess, his wife, keeps a boarding house mostly for horse folks that's here for the races. Right east for maybe a mile, taking a left on Iberville. Take a right after 6 blocks, following Rampart for 2 miles, and look for a sign that'll say Bayou Road. There's a sign pointing to McQueen's, and you can see the horse barn from the road.
We're obliged.
Nathan and Yuli rode on, receiving curious looks from people they met along the way. Eventually, they crossed a wide boulevard, and there were 2 faded signs nailed to a post at the corner.
This is Orleans. The other must be French. Vieux Car.
They were less than a mile west of Bayou Road, and once they were on it, the town quickly fell away. They passed beneath mighty oaks from which the leaves had fallen, leaving only wraiths of Spanish moss trailing from barren limbs.
So peaceful. I like it.
It reminds me of the old South before the war.
I can't see that the war even touched it. Did it?
Louisiana seceded in 1861. Farragut moved Federals into Vicksburg, Natchez, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans in 1862. The Rebs never got this far, from what I've heard. We didn't get deep enough into town. I'd bet my saddle there's soldiers here somewhere.
Despite the seclusion of the McQueen place, it wasn't that far from town. And they soon were able to see the outbuildings on their right. The road led them down a tree-lined lane, and a message burned into a slab of oak welcomed them to McQueen's. Three hounds loped to meet them. Cotton Blossom rose to the challenge.
They'll eat him alive.
Just when it seemed the prophecy was about to be fulfilled, the trio was halted in the tracks.
Come here, you dogs!
The hounds turned and loped away. Cotton Blossom, aware that he'd had nothing to do with their retreat, wisely gave up pursuit. Nathan and Yuli reined up, waiting as the man who called off the dogs approached. The enormous structure from which he had emerged looked to be 300 yards in length, with adjoining corrals at either end. To the south of it, there were other outbuildings that looked like conventional barns. There was no house in sight. Nathan and Yuli turned their attention to the big man.
I'm Barnabas McQueen.
He was maybe 6.5 feet tall, somewhere past 50, and weighed a good 200, none of it fat. He had gray hair, friendly blue eyes, and he dressed like a Westerner. His riding boots were jet black and newly polished, while his brown Levi's and red checked flannel shirt were clean. His gray Stetson looked new.
I'm Nathan Stone, and my partner's Eli Prater. We aim to be in these parts for a while. As you can see, we have three horses and a dog. When we asked the Teamster about a decent place to board for a spell, he sent us to you.
You need to talk to Bess. We don't actually have a boarding house. They're just cabins with bunks. Sleeping quarters where you can stash your saddles and belongings. There's a cookhouse with a full-time cook. We feed three times a day, but you're a mite early. The next race is set for December 29th. The first Saturday after Christmas.
You cater mostly to folks here for the horse races, then?
Usually, but we don't turn away teamsters, drummers, or anybody else that don't hanker to stay in town. Sleeping quarters and meals is $1 a day or $20 a month. Same for each of the horses.
My God, that's high for stabling a horse.
That includes grain, my friend. You must remember, there's been a war going on. We haven't had a decent crop of anything since 1860. The grain comes from St. Louis, by steamboat. Why don't you ride around and compare? I'm sure you can beat our prices, but I must warn you. During the week or so before the race, the others all doubled their prices. We don't.
Nathan, I like it here.
So do I. We'll stay a spell.
Ride on to the house, then. It's over yonder, beyond the barns. You can stable your horses in the second one.
He watched him ride away, and Yuli waited until they were well out of his hearing before she spoke again.
You're always forgetting that I have $2,000. This will be worth twice what he's asking. At least we didn't have to come up with a story as to why we're here. You don't look all that innocent with a colt on each hip.
None of his damn business. He took it upon himself, assuming we're here for a horse race. Hell, that's 10 weeks off.
No matter. We're going to that race. At least I am. In the old days before the war, Daddy owned some thoroughbreds. I've ridden in a race or two myself. That's why I took Daddy's horse. I trained him.
Damn, haven't seen you naked as a skint coyote. I reckon there wasn't any secrets left. Now you tell me you train and ride thoroughbreds. You find that easier than roping and branding men?
I do, and a hell of a lot more satisfying. Horses are smarter, they learn faster, and unless they're mistreated, they don't get ornery and bite at you.
By then, they were almost to the house. Built of logs, it was squat and sprawling with two chimneys. A few yards from the main house was another log structure that looked like the cookhouse McQueen had mentioned. Beside it was stacked three head-high ricks of stove-length wood. Smoke spiraled from the chimney, and the air was rich with the tantalizing aroma of cooking food. Well beyond the house, there was a line of lesser log structures that had to be the cabins where the boarders slept. By the time they reached the long porch, the front door had been opened by a woman who seemed a fitting companion for Barnabas McQueen.
Welcome, I'm Bess.
She was tall and still slender, and the years had been kind to her. While there was gray in her hair, there was youth in her eyes.
I'm Nathan Stone, ma'am, and my partner's Eli Prater. We'll be needing room and board for a while. We spoke to Barnabas on the way in. There'll be us, our three horses, and my dog, Cotton Blossom. Here's $100 for us and the horses for a month. Barnabas didn't say how much for the dog.
And he'd better not. There's no charge for him. Already I'm feeding that pack of four-legged gluttons that Barnabas keeps, and not one of them worth the shells it'd take to blow their heads off. Take your pick of the sleeping quarters right now. They're all empty. Stable your horses in the nearest barn. We'll have supper in an hour.
While the cabins were small, they were comfortable, with bed, dresser with mirror, water pitcher and basin, and a pair of cane-bottomed ladder-back chairs. There was a coal oil lamp on the dresser and curtains in each of the two windows. The back door opened to reveal an outhouse. A large braided oval rug covered most of the floor.
I can't imagine there being a better place in all of New Orleans.
I'm glad you like it, but I'm not likely to learn anything out here. I'm after two killers, and I look to find them somewhere in town, in the gambling houses or the saloons.
After supper, let's ask McQueen if we can go to the stables where he keeps his thoroughbreds. I'd like to see them.
When Nathan and Yuli answered the cook bell's call, they found their hosts taking their meal in the cookhouse. Bess McQueen introduced the cook, a graying little man in a chef's hat, as simply Pierre.
Pierre speaks English tolerably well, but when he gets steamed, he cusses entirely in French. I reckon that's why Bess hired him.
That, and he's an excellent cook.
Following a superb meal, after final cups of coffee, Yuli mentioned the horses.
Mr. McQueen, do you mind if we go to the stable? I enjoy horses, and I'd like to look at your thoroughbreds.
Don't mind at all. It won't take long, since I only have three. Bess, are you coming with us?
No.
Through the cool of the evening, with sundown just minutes away, they walked to the distant stables. It still being daylight outside did nothing to diminish the gloom within the stable, and McQueen took a lantern from a peg beside the door. Even in the poor light from the lantern, it became obvious why the building was so enormous, for an oval horse track dominated the center of it.
Being so near the Gulf, there are times when we have three or four straight days of rain. Weather is not fit for man or beast.
The stable consisted of many stalls, all of them arranged around the oval that was the track.
That's Diablo making all the noise. I don't know what I'm going to do with him. Thoroughbreds can be high-strung, temperamental, and nervous, but Diablo goes beyond all that.
He's never been raced, then.
Not that I know of.
The stalls had Dutch doors, allowing only the top half to be opened. Thus, one could see into a stall without being kicked or trampled by a nervous or frightened horse. McQueen opened the Dutch doors to one of the stalls, and the horse, a gray, stood there quietly looking at them.
This is Prince. He's won considerable money for me.
McQueen opened the Dutch doors to the next stall, revealing a chestnut. And while he didn't seem as calm as Prince, neither was he frightened.
And this is Duke. He's the youngest of the three, and I'm working with him now.
All geldings, I reckon.
All geldings. Otherwise, they couldn't keep their minds on the race with mares around.
Finally, they reached the stall where the third horse still snorted and kicked the walls.
Better stand back. He can't get out. But when I open the upper halves of these doors, he may try to bite your ears off.
A big black with a white star on his forehead, Diablo didn't lunge at them, but he flattened his ears and bared his teeth. While Nathan stood behind McQueen, Yuli hadn't backed away.
Donzo. Oh, Donzo. Honchy? Oh. Buddha. Hidden.
The big black horse seemed to understand. The ears perked up and the terrible teeth were no longer bared. Without a word, Barnabas McQueen stepped aside. The horse came a step closer.
Queen Asiye, do mika, nahigada, gojali ni gai tahni.
Yuli went no closer, and Diablo remained where he was, seeming to understand every word spoken. It all ended as suddenly as it had begun when Yuli stepped back. McQueen closed and latched the doors, and almost immediately Diablo began pawing and nickering.
I've never seen anything like that. What did you say? And how in thunder did he...
Something I learned years ago in South Texas from an old Indian horse gentler. He was a Lapan Apache, and I spoke as he did in the Apache tongue.
No wonder I didn't understand. What did you say? What is the secret?
No secret. I just told him he's a handsome horse. And I want to become his compa fiero, his comrade. Perhaps it's a music of the words.
Gentle him, train him, get him ready for this next race, and I'll pay you $500.
No, I won't take your money. Diablo is honest with me, and I'll be honest with him. Should we become friends, it'll only be because the two of us desire it. I will become his friend, and perhaps later on, should you conduct yourself properly, he'll become your friend.
Barnabas McQueen had been profoundly impressed. Nathan said nothing until he and Yuli reached their cabin. When he finally spoke, it struck her the wrong way.
Sometimes, I forget you're not a man.
I can believe that. You haven't laid a hand on me since Corpus Christi, before you were shot. Don't I have everything in all the right places?
Yes, you're everything you should be. It's, Damn it, I don't know what's wrong with me. For a while, with you there in South Texas, I just forgot I was trailing a bunch of killers. Now I know that a pair of them are here, in New Orleans, and they're heavy on my mind. I have trouble thinking of anything else.
How well I know. I had you for a while, and you were Nathan Stone the man. Now you're riding the vengeance trail again, and you're Nathan Stone the killer.
The truth hurts. What do you aim to do?
I can't go back to Waco. I'll stick with you. Help you if I can. Bury you if I must. But if you ever again turn to me, I want it to be you wanting me, not because I tried to force you into it. Go on back to the saloons and gambling halls. I'll gentle McQueen's horse if I can.
I never knew you felt that strong about horses.
I've never been hurt or disappointed by a horse.
In the house, the McQueens were very much awake and talking.
I tell you, Bess, I never saw anything like it. Why, the confounded horse would have taken off my head if I'd been close enough. But this praetor spoke some gibberish, some Apache tongue.
And wouldn't take your money.
Well, that's the damn mystery of it. A down-at-the-heels rider with nothing but a horse and a saddle.
No mystery, Barnabas. This praetor's a Texan. So was my father. He'd work for nothing if he believed the cause worthy. And if he felt it unworthy, there wasn't enough gold in the world to buy him. Besides, these riders, especially Stone, are here for some reason other than a horse race.
I reckon you're right about Praetor being a Texan, but I ain't sure about Stone.
I am. He walks, talks, and rides like a Westerner, but I have the feeling he's a Southerner who went west after the war. You know, they didn't actually tell us they're here for the race. We just assumed they were. While I don't know who Stone is, I doubt he carries those two tied-down pistols for show.
You reckon he's running from the law?
If he isn't, he will be. You know, the Federals are using the Reconstruction Law to take away the guns of Southerners.
Unless they happen to be part of a gambling empire owned by a scoundrel like French Stumberg.
That kind of talk can get you killed. And even if you had proof, there's nothing to be done.
Stumberg should have stayed with his fancy gambling halls and steamboats. Now he's got himself some fast horses and reckons he can steal our races like he steals everything else. The first sign of anything crooked, and somehow, I'm going after him.